Welcome to Level With Us, the bonusode. We're releasing some unheard content from previous interviews to explore a topic more in depth, look at it through a new lens, or different perspective. These shorter sodes will also give us the opportunity to answer any questions from listeners. So if you want to know more about a topic, or you just want us to look at a housing-related issue that we haven't yet covered, go to the Level With Us page on our website, homeportohio.org, and fill out the form. All right, let's get into it. Today, I am with Roy Lowenstein, an affordable housing consultant who has worked with Homeport for the last 8 years. In his nearly 50-year career, Roy has brought more than 250 projects online and about 7,000 homes for families, seniors, and individuals with disabilities. He also serves as zoning chair for the Near East Area Commission, representing the interests of his neighborhood in the consideration of new developments. Roy brings a person-focused insight to the new zoning code, considering the history of Columbus, the factors that have delayed housing and infrastructure development, and the very personal component to the broader topic of regional growth.
It's a 1950s suburban kind of code, but it was overlaid on, like in the central city, on neighborhoods that don't have 50-foot lots. And so, like, that's the requirement for a lot. Well, you got a 30-foot lot or a 35-foot lot or whatever, and so even if you want to build a house on that, you have to get a zoning variance for lot size and often setbacks and things like that. So almost everything comes through the commission to make a recommendation to city council or to the Board of Zoning Appeals for the zonings that people need to do almost everything.
So even in the 50s, this code didn't work, is what you're saying?
Well, it worked in the sense that it was a built-out neighborhood. You didn't have a whole lot of construction going on in the neighborhood at that point. You know, it was before things started to fall apart. So, you know, all of the things we hear about, you know, that were done wrong impacted that neighborhood as much as any. Linden, Near East Area, Hilltop, Franklinton, and the South Side all got, you know, all kind of went downhill for a number of years and only have more recently started to turn around.
Roy is referring to the disinvestment and destruction that was done to predominantly black neighborhoods in the 60s and 70s. On the Near East Side, that meant the construction of highways like I-70, 71, and 670 that cut the community into pieces, leaving the predominantly white Bexley unscathed, a modern-day redlining. Combine this with efforts of urban renewal and slum clearance, and you get once thriving neighborhoods that are entirely displaced. Now, as the city prepares for wide-scale development, fears of further displacement and neighborhood changes happening to a community, rather than with that community leading the effort, are driving the concern and trepidation when it comes to the new proposed zoning code. The question continues to be, how do we address our housing crisis responsibly? How do we bring more housing into neighborhoods, inject and maintain affordability, and build out our transportation infrastructure to support that density, all in a way that respects and reflects the priorities of our current community members? It's true, we are no longer the Columbus of the 60s, 70s, or 80s, but those residents are still here.
Now you have people coming in wanting to build, but like I say, everything they want to build requires a zoning change. So we have a whole process we go through with people, and ultimately the commission votes on it. We're like a city body. We're legally a public entity that holds public meetings and all that. And so we make our recommendations. They don't always follow them, but they often do.
I'm curious then, in your storied career, when did you notice the language about Columbus changing into this, we're the next big metro? I mean, we were a cow town.
We were. Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. There were three Chinese restaurants in all of Columbus, and, you know, none of them were really any good. And it's just like the range of things we have in restaurants and entertainment, and just it's amazing how much the city has grown. But it began to change in the mid-'80s. People began to come into Columbus from the East Coast. Like, companies in New York or other cities started setting up a office out here. And it started bringing new people into Columbus. with, you know, and they were used to new things that weren't here. And so you just started seeing the commercial world begin to change to adapt to that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as the industrial cities of Ohio continued, you know, to go downhill in terms of population, people started coming here. You just started seeing it. It's picked up speed, honestly, but this is something that's been going on now quite a long time, like 35 years or so of Columbus becoming a magnet.
Do you feel the housing conversation started at the same time, or are we late to that?
No, the housing conversation wasn't the same as it's become, because I would say there wasn't a shortage. The market was functioning more effectively to absorb the increase, and it wasn't as quick an increase either. I feel like the market was working better. Planners probably saw what was happening,
Yeah. But
you didn't see a lot being said about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Columbus doesn't have a history of being a particularly planned city.
Our lack of transit options reflects this delay in planning. Linkus is coming on the ballot this year, and while it's the first time such a sweeping initiative is being seriously considered, researched, and potentially funded, pending a vote, it's not the first time the need for broader access to transportation has been discussed. Anyone with a Reddit account can recall thousands of posts lamenting over the lack of light rail.
There's no question Columbus is a car-centric city.
Yeah.
I think, you know, decisions could have been made 30 years ago, but there was no desire to spend the kind of money that needed to be spent to put in light rail or to change the bus system into something that would be more like public transportation is on the East Coast, say, where, you know, I grew up in New York City, mm-hmm. and like everyone takes the bus, everybody takes the subway. Could Columbus have been that? I don't know. I mean, we don't have the density to have made that as economically a favorable decision. And when people looked at the numbers, they went, this is gonna require subsidy forever. It's never gonna be self-sufficient. And it didn't feel good to people. And they decided, no, we're not gonna stick the voters with that. I'm not judging whether that was the right or wrong decision necessarily. I'm just saying when those decisions were made and the bus system really didn't change, you know, we have a bus system that, except for a few lines, is really transportation of last resort for a lot of people. That's the way the middle class looks at it.
It could be said that the lack of movement on key issues like housing and transportation, the lack of planning, was in itself action by way of inaction. Columbus has a history of letting the market rule.
Columbus was always a place that was, you know, it's very market-oriented. It was very business-friendly city.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the work I did early in my career, I one of the reasons I stayed here was Columbus was a really easy place to do real estate. Sure, there were all the things like community groups would fight you and all of that. I don't mean that NIMBY wasn't a problem. It was. But I mean that the government agencies were relatively easy to work with. They just wanted to see growth, and it was all very pro-growth. So it was a good place to do real estate. And land was relatively cheap, too. Another thing that was true back in the 70s and 80s was the zoning changes that were made in the 60s, like a lot, if you look at where Homeport's portfolio is, a lot of those properties around the Outer Belt,
mm-hmm.
like Emerald Glen that we, you know, submitted to OFA for funding this year, those properties were built on land that was just zoned permissively.
Yeah.
The city went out there, you know, looked at all of that farmland that they had annexed, and they said, let's zone it for apartments. And you know, that's why it looks the way it does now. You have these large apartment areas. But, you know, in a sense, that's what they're trying to recreate. It was an effective strategy to get multifamily development to happen.
Yeah.
And so for a while, that certainly absorbed a fair amount of the population growth, too.
Whether it was foreseen or not, the growth is here. And we're no longer at the point where we can absorb it at the right rate. Despite this, as stated, there's a hesitation to embrace change among residents who have been here for decades.
One of the things about this code is I think even if you talk to the developers, people are saying, it's, you know, this is all good, but don't expect too much too soon. And I think that's true of public attitudes also.
Yeah.
The public is going to have some issues with some of the changes that are happening. And it's going to take a while for people to adjust. I'm the sort of person who always looks for middle ground on things.
Yeah.
I've done that my whole life. And often that works. You know, if someone says one and the other person says three, then two often is a good solution, you know. Mm-hmm. But this is a tough one to find middle ground on, this whole zoning change. It's like it's hard to find technical solutions to a housing shortage that allow just for what we typically call gentle density.
Mm.
So what,
say
what,
more about that.
What's happened, see, in terms of my work on the Near East Area Commission, we're always in favor of a proposal that comes in that fits that description of gentle density. For example, you have a single family lot or say a double lot, and somebody wants to come in, but instead of building two houses, they want to build two doubles. Or they want to build two doubles and put a carriage house on the back or something like that. Now, that kind of thing, that can fit in a neighborhood like that. And instead of getting two units, you get four or five or something like that. That's what we mean by gentle density. Or there's a developer, he's got a design where he wants to put a three-level building up, three units, but it looks like a three-story house from the front, you know, but it's not. It's three flats that are all, like, I think, one-bedroom units. So it's like that sort of thing, you could put that anywhere, and it's not, in terms of its mass or anything else about it, it's not really destructive of the feel of the neighborhood,
right.
But it's you've added additional units that way instead of just building a house. And that kind of thing is relatively easy for people to get used to.
I brought up the topic of gentle density with Erin Prosser during our discussion for episode 5. While she acknowledged the need and the value, her focus and the city's focus continues to be on densifying Columbus on a larger scale, both making up for our more than 50,000 unit shortage and making headway on the number of units needed to house an incoming population of about 1 million.
What we know is we need in this region about 200,000 homes to be built between now and 10 to 15 years from now. Mm-hmm. Make up for what we haven't built and then accommodate the new growth that's coming in. That's a pretty extraordinary number. And what we know is in Minneapolis, they did both, they did a corridor rezoning to allow density and height increases along their corridors. And they've also famously eliminated single-family housing, right? As you can build up to fourplexes on any lot in Minneapolis. What we know from the outcomes over the last number of years that it's been in place is less than 2% of the supply that's been built in Minneapolis has come from the gentle density side.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important for housing diversity. It's really important for how we get more units into individual neighborhoods that are more built out. It is really important, but the biggest bang for our buck is going to be along the corridors.
Yeah.
And what we know through the new zoning code, we had a group out of Oregon called Cascadia, and we asked them the question, reasonably, what could be built in the near term, which we would call 10 to 15 years, in the corridors that we're looking to rezone, what can be built under the current zoning? And they looked at the capacity, they balance it against market forces, so it is calibrated for kind of where our rents are, where land costs are, construction costs. And what they found was under the current zoning code, the capacity for new construction is about 6,000 units in the next 10 to 15 years. Put that against 200,000 that we need, it's really
sad.
Yes, it is not going to cover what we need, right? And the ability to densify the corridors, we're going to miss that opportunity. And that changes the degree to which we sprawl, right? It affects our ability to eat up farmland if we don't build up along these corridors. So then we asked the second question of Cascadia. Now that we've got our code, what does it mean in the next 10 to 15 years if we were to redevelop under the proposed code?
Yeah.
And again, they calibrated against the market, looked at kind of different land costs and rents that could be captured. The new zoning code in the near term has the capacity to deliver 88,000 units.
Right.
That is a meaningful contribution to the 200,000.
Yeah.
Then we look at how do we supplement that with things like gentle densities? How do we go out to our communities and talk about what do ADUs look like in your neighborhood? What does it look like to have duplexes and fourplexes come back into the community?
So what the city has done, their strategy has been here, let's do what seems easiest first. We'll see how easy it turns out to be, but figuring that we already have taller buildings on these main thoroughfares, and so people will adjust to that. And that may be, you know, I'm hopeful that something similar to what they proposed does get adopted, because even if it doesn't generate the housing growth that we need, it'll happen over time. You're creating an environment in which that change can occur when the economic conditions are right.
Level With Us is brought to you by Homeport and is recorded, mixed, and edited by Lauren Sega. All sources are in the show notes. Homeport creates strong communities by developing quality, affordable homes on a cornerstone of dignity, security, and opportunity. To learn more, or if you'd like to support our mission, visit us at homeportohio.org.